Welcome. It's nice to be here. Last week, we had a Zendo that was completely packed with people. And this morning is a little different. It's Memorial Day. Or tomorrow's Memorial Day. Memorial Day weekend. So here we are. My name is Musho, also known as Rodney Allen Greenblatt, and I'm a senior student here at the Village Zendo. And thanks to all you who came out on Memorial Day weekend to hear, to be sit with us and to hear my talk. I really do appreciate it. And all those that listen to this as a podcast also, thank you so much for listening. It is a rainy, muggy, fortunately not that hot, but swampy day here in New York City. And a few of us got drenched this morning as we came in. It seems to have tapered off a bit, wet. As I said, the day before Memorial Day. And I wasn't going to say very much about Memorial Day, but I think I will say there really is something to it. I'm a pacifist. I would like war to be abolished. But there are people who die doing their jobs, basically. And it is something to commemorate. They go out there and they do that. It's hard to even imagine. And sometimes they don't come home. So that's where we're at. The other side of Memorial Day is that it is the first day of summer in a certain unofficial way. And it's time for barbecues and getting together with people. So that's what's happening. But now for the Dharma talk. And I'm going to start with a little section from the Blue Cliff Record, one of our great pieces of Zen literature. And it's from a pointer. And it goes like this. There's nothing outside the great vastness. It's as fine as atomic dust. Holding on and letting go are not another's doing. Rolling up and rolling out rest with oneself. If you want to free what is stuck and loosen what is bound, you simply must cut away the traces of thought and swallow the sounds of words. All people occupy the essential crossing place, and every one towers up like a 1,000-fathom wall. Tell me, whose realm is this? To test, I'm citing this case. Musho, while speaking to the assembly, asked, "What's your thing? What's your thing, anyway?" This question came to me from reading an article in the New York Times. And the article was from January of this year. And the article is called, "Don't Let a Lack of Self-Awareness Hold You Back," written by Tim Herrera, and the article starts out like this. I'll read you the first section. A close friend and I have this agreement. If one of us ever recognizes the other person's thing, we're bound to disclose what it is, no matter what. But what is a person's thing, exactly? It's a particular behavior, habit, or mindset that is self-destructive, but we're completely blind to. Personally, professionally, or otherwise, it's something that's holding us back from achieving our full potential. But for whatever reason, we simply can't see it ourselves. That level of self-awareness is quite elusive. Although some 95% of people think they're self-aware, only about 10 to 15% truly are, according to one study. And this is the kind of thing, like, when you've been doing a lot of Zen practice, you read these things, and suddenly there's a Dharma, like, light. It's like, it's so, well, in my view, he says his friend is going to disclose what your thing is. And I think that Zen is a little bit like that. Zen is kind of asking, what's your thing? Or what's my thing? And the questions in the koans and in our Zen stories that the monks ask are kind of similar to, what's your thing? Does a dog have Buddha nature or not? What is the meaning of the patriarch coming from the West? What is the highest meaning of the holy truth? And what's the one we're working on now? What's the fundamental constant principle? Those monks that are asking those questions, I think, are kind of asking, what's my thing, in a certain way? Well, the New York Times article, also in it, this is a little complicated, but in that article, it references another article. And I had to look up what that article was, and that article was from some kind of weird web magazine called Hairpin. That was also from January. And that article was called, What's Your Thing? And it's written by an author just called Bonnie. It's some kind of a blog or something. So Bonnie says this. A few years ago, a friend looked me right in the eye. I want to tell you something, she said. I want to tell you what your thing is. I said, my thing? Yes, everyone has a thing standing in your way, stopping you, that everyone can see but you. And you need someone in your life who's honest enough to tell you what your thing is. I want to do that for you. Yes, I said, please do. My friend nodded. She took a breath, and then she told me, Bonnie, stop fucking with your hair and get a boyfriend with a job. Zen masters also use this same direct language to answer. In case 21 of the Gateless Barrier, a monk asks, Unman, what is Buddha? Unman says, a shit stick. Stop fucking with your hair and get a boyfriend with a job. It's similar. It's very similar. I think the monks in these stories are asking this question. And they want to know. They want to know something about themselves. They want to know if the ideals that they're pursuing are the right ones. They want to know if there are barriers and what those barriers are and how can I pass them. They want to know what their shortcomings are. We all do. And of course, they want to know, how can I change to be a better person? What's my thing? I myself have spent some time on the meditation cushion, a little bit. And I've had some face-to-face meetings myself with Zen masters. Thank you, Roshi. And in both cases, my thing is there. And for the example of in meditation, I'm sitting there and I lose track of my breath. I start thinking about something. And then if I'm lucky, I start thinking about thinking. And if I'm very lucky, I might think, what am I thinking about this for? That would be a good kind of Zazen experience. Why am I thinking this? And on a long retreat especially, I might really start to wonder, what is my thing? What is going on with me? In the interview room, one of my ways is to give some kind of idea-based, clever presentation. And it's all about ideas and what I think. And the teachers, with their grandmotherly kindness, tell me what a clever idea I have and that it's not it. And then my thing, like what it is that's blocking me, that causes me to go in another direction, seems to be there. And as the articles say, it's almost impossible to see your thing yourself. But I thought I would give it a try to describe to you right now what I think my thing is. And I've rewritten this section quite a few times. And I've come down to this about what Musho, my very own thing, is. I use cleverness, generosity, and humor to get whatever I want. I can sweet talk or pretend my way out of uncomfortable situations or casually avoid them. I'm quite good at it. For about 57 years, I've been using this method, but it does have a downside, and that is it's very hard to grow emotionally when you're able to push everything to the side. And also, there's probably a pile of unexamined fears that never get attended to when I'm so good at avoiding these things. Now, it's very hard to psychoanalyze yourself, but it's a pretty good exercise. So if you wanted to try tonight when you're home, get a piece of paper and try to write down what your thing is. And I think you'll be surprised. And I also think it takes a little bit of edge, maybe of the negative feelings you might have about yourself. It might help a little bit. I think it did help me to write that down. So give it a try. So in the Times article, as I said, it mentions that your thing is pretty much impossible to see. And in the second part of the article, there's the brutally honest friend. And I think for Zen students, Zen itself is like the brutally honest friend. But it's kind of different and better than the brutally honest friend because Zen is asking you to find it out for yourself, to make that leap and answer your own question. And I think in that way, the answer becomes a little more profound. But before I talk a little bit about the profound, I want to say that there is a limit to what Zen or your brutally honest friend can do for you if your thing involves hurting yourself or hurting other people. There's another realm of what your thing is, and some people may be brought into an intense depression or rage, and those realms are outside of Zen and your brutally honest friend. If those problems are like that for you, then I beg you to find professional help, psychology and doctors who help people with those kind of problems. So I'm making a little fun here of what your thing might be, but for some people it's extremely serious. And if you're listening to this podcast and feel that way about yourself, like you might want to hurt yourself, please find some help. Back to our practice. Zen, of course, is a part of Buddhism. And Buddha himself was very, very clear about what your thing is. And it's the second noble truth, basically. Suffering is caused by clinging. And the way the Buddha describes it, it's not just your thing, it's everyone's thing. Everyone is clinging to words and clinging to names and clinging to ideas and notions and beliefs and clinging to the future and clinging to the past, clinging to outcomes, expectations, and endless imaginary versions of ourselves, endless imaginary versions of what the world should be. And this kind of clinging is the self-destructive habit and mindset that most of us are completely blind to. So what could we do? What can we do about this problem that's so hard to see? The separation from ourselves that's so natural to everyone, what can we do? I have two hints for you. One is from Bodhidharma, and the second one from Dogen. So let's hear from Bodhidharma first. Everything that appears in the three realms comes from the mind. Hence, Buddhas of the past and future teach mind to mind without bothering about definitions. But if they don't define it, what do they mean by mind, you ask? That's your mind, I answer. That's my mind. If I had no mind, how could I answer? If you had no mind, how could you ask? That which asks is your mind. Through endless kalpas without beginning, whatever you do, wherever you are, that's your real mind. That's your real Buddha. And here's Dogen. When the Dharma does not fill your whole body and mind, you may assume it is already sufficient. But when Dharma fills your body and mind, you understand that something is missing. For example, when you sail out in a boat to the middle of the ocean where no land is in sight and view the four directions, the ocean looks circular and does not look any other way. But the ocean is neither round nor square. Its features are infinite in variety. It is like a palace. It is like a jewel. It only looks circular as far as you can see at that time. All things are like this. I love that. It's from Genjo Koan. The circular ocean. But you know, the shore and the land is complicated and varied. But sometimes that's all we can see. Just where we are. And I think Dogen isn't judging the person who can only see that disc around him. Dogen isn't judging that person at all. I think that's one of the wonderful things about that section. But I think what both of these passages might be pointing at, and this is just my own take here, is that there might be no such thing as your thing. It might not be real. That you and me, right now, right here as we are already free. Already free of our clinging and free of our thing. And that there aren't any barriers. And the only thing that really exists is reality right now, this moment. That's really wonderful and very freeing. And the reality of this moment, here we are in this room, includes everything. Because we've brought everything with us, all our past experiences and abilities and knowledge. We're here right now with those. And not only are we all here together with our talents and abilities and compassion for each other to be here, but we're also bringing our shortcomings and our prejudices and our fears and even our selfishness. We might be bringing that with us. And it's all right here. It's all completely included. There's no separate other world. So then what? What if the future better you and the future better world that might be out there disappears? Then this is it. And I think when this is it is established, then suddenly there's less clinging. Because what could you possibly attach to? And there'd be less things to want. And then when there's less things to want, there's a lot more time to take care of yourself and to take care of others and do what you want to do to make this world better. The time suddenly appears when you're not grabbing. And also, I think when this is it is established, there's less fighting. There's less fear. There's less lying. There's less cheating. And the need for violence and oppression fades a little bit. And in my case, maybe less cleverness and avoiding being uncomfortable might be okay. Might be a relief. So whatever your thing is, it's included in what is only mind, as Bodhidharma says. And if it's only mine, then where is it? It kind of loses its power. The Blue Cliff Record says, "All people occupy the essential crossing place. Each and every one towers up like a 1,000-fathom wall." We can practice like that. We can do our zazen just like that. Our ultra-simple posture of sitting quietly and facing the wall, when we do that, we tower up. And in the space of meditation, we can include our faults and our shortcomings, our traumas, our joys, our love, and even our thing, whatever it is. It could be part of your meditation. When we sit and we do our meditation, we're basically exercising our awareness in a certain way. And awareness is beautiful because whatever the nature of your awareness is, that's your awareness. If it's busy, your mind is busy, or you're feeling dull and hot, if you're bored, if you think this is all so beautiful, that's your awareness. And in your meditation practice, you get to explore and experience it. And you get to see how it comes and goes, how it's transient in a certain way. And I love that. I love being able to do that. And to do that together is really wonderful. And I really wish more people would sit down and face the wall. It's really not difficult. And there's so much to see and understand in our silence. So, in your meditation practice, don't let a lack of self-awareness hold you back. In sitting facing the wall, we experience our awareness just as it is. And there isn't any lack. And there isn't a proper amount. It's just our thing as it is. Thank you so much for listening.